Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be jewelry. Either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape.
Welcome to another week of Whitley on Wine. I'm your host, Robert Whitley.
And I'm Lisa Redwine from the Shores in La Jolla.
And Lisa is my guest co-host this week, and she will be the guest host all by herself next week. And who are you bringing in?
You know, I have two exciting people coming in. Two sommeliers will be talking about wines for the holidays. One is Dan Chapman from George's at the Cove. The other is Megan Yalinowski, and she'll be giving us kind of more the home perspective for the holidays.
Well, and I will be in the Napa Valley.
Lucky you.
Visiting wineries and tasting wine, and I'll try to, if I can be near a computer, I'll try to listen.
Oh, very good. Well, just a little jealous.
Yeah. So anyway, our guest today is George Bursick, the great winemaker at Jay Vineyards and Winery. And prior to Jay, George was the longtime winemaker at Ferrari Carano.
Yes.
And welcome, George. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, Robert. Thank you for having me on the show today.
How was your Thanksgiving?
It was excellent.
Did they make you cook?
Actually, this is the first year that I really haven't. We had a smaller than usual crowd, and I was able to just enjoy a glass of wine or two and watch everybody else do the work.
I bet you they made you bring the wine.
That's always the case.
Yeah, I know that feeling. I'm sure Lisa does too.
Oh yeah.
You know, I show up for dinner and people expect me to have a little bag.
Uh-huh. You know that's your question is, are they inviting me for that reason or not?
Mm-hmm. You know, we had a wonderful lunch at Kraft in Los Angeles a few months ago, and you know, Jay is well known for its sparkling wine, and you're doing some interesting new things with the sparkling wine program at Jay. But you were very, very excited about your Pinot Noir program, which you are expanding tremendously. And I was hoping that during your, I guess we can't call an appearance on the radio.
Right.
During your visit with us here on the radio,
uh-huh.
that you could explain a little bit about your philosophy on Pinot Noir and what you're doing that's different.
Oh, sure. I'd love to. I'd like to say it's a pleasure having Lisa on board this, too. So wish you luck on your interview next week.
Oh, she'll do great.
Well, let's talk Pinot Noir.
We'll get to bubbly, but I just really wanted to get that Pinot Noir out there.
Sure.
Because,
no, I'd love
because
to.
Because it was a let's, fascinating conversation. You had, I think we tasted four or five different Pinots.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And I think that's sort of a revelation. That would be sort of a revelation for most people who have followed Jay. There's been one Pinot, and then there were two, and then now suddenly there are four or five. And
it's gone crazy, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much, when I came on board with Judy Jordan, who's the owner of Jay. In fact, she and I have been long-term friends. I came on board in about spring of 2006. And you're right, up to that time, only two Pinot Noirs had been produced here, two vineyard designates, the Robert Thomas and the Nicoles.
Mm-hmm.
And they produced a little bit of a Russian River, but it was a pretty limited program. And I joined Jay initially as a winemaking consultant, and went out to some of the vineyards within the Russian River that Judy has, she owns, and I was just flabbergasted. These are just like incredible premium vineyards within the Russian River Valley that were growing primarily to sparkling. And so I convinced her to, you know, sort of change directions a little bit and still retain the sparkling, but really expand the Pinot Noir programs here. And since then, I think we've expanded our vineyard holdings. I'm looking at a map here of the Russian River Valley, to about, we're sourcing from about 15 vineyards within the Russian River itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it really has expanded the where the fruit sourced from. And then, you know, my wonderful days at Ferrari Carano, I had an opportunity, is pretty much known as the Sangiovese guy of California.
Sangiovese and Chardonnay.
And you know, you'd be surprised at the similarities between Sangiovese and Pinot Noir. It's just, you know, they could be the same variety. I mean, just they have the same growing characteristics and the same problematic, issues.
Are you trying to say that they're both a pain in the butt?
Sort of, yeah. They're very, anytime you get a very thin skin that likes colder areas, it's always a recipe for trouble, because you're always fighting the weather and the problems that early rains cause, mm-hmm. and all that. But so I sort of took a step back and took a look at how Pinot was produced, not only here at Jay, but in the industry as a whole, and really sort of made some startling changes to the entire program. One of which, I firmly believe that in Burgundy, where, you know, we know Pinot Noir is king, mm-hmm. Their hang time, their growing time, is so much more extended. It's such a cooler area than we have here in California. So consequently, the seeds, which are a measure of ripeness in a vine, the seeds are a nice chocolate brown in Burgundy. Well, California, we have plenty of sunshine, so we get sugar ripeness early, but physiologically ripe, where we need those brown seeds, comes quite later than we'd like. I mean, the grapes would be a tendency to be overripe. So I sort of initiated kind of a revolutionary new concept here, is we get rid of the seeds. We just sort them out, and so we're fermenting on relatively seedless must.
And yeah.
So we don't have that challenge of controlling the unripe tannins that are so frequently extracted in Pinot.
And allow me to interject. I think one of my criticisms of some California Pinot Noir from the cooler climates like Santa Rita Hills, some of the Sonoma Coast Appalachian, is you get wonderful fruit aromas, because you do get that sugar ripeness, but there's that bitterness on the back end from those unripe seeds.
Yeah, and that's really tough to beat, because if you let them hang out there, and you say, okay, I'll just extend the ripening time until the seeds catch up with the sugar,
mm-hmm.
well, often you're backed into the rainy season, which is, you know, horrible. I mean, because who wants to pick grapes in the rain or after the rain?
And you're also looking at 15% alcohol,
exactly.
Pinot Noir,
exactly,
which loses
those
all
the
its elegance.
Two downsides to it, so. And they're both unpredictable. You can't control that. Whereas if we just sort of assume that, that we're going to remove the seeds during our fermentation, then that takes that sort of uncertainty out of the equation.
And the result, of course, is, or the proof, is in the bottle. And when we tasted your Pinots at Kraft, I was pleasantly, I won't say surprised, because I know what you're doing, but as I said, one of my criticisms of California Pinot in recent vintages is it's been getting better, but you have a lot of that kind of green bitter tannin, which, to my way of thinking, from my experience as a longtime wine collector, when you get that bitterness, it very seldom disappears.
It rarely outlives
the fruit.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So, but so that's it's kind of fun, you know. Well, you know, this all comes from seems like 100 years ago. I was at did my graduate work at Davis, but I specifically did it in wine body and texture of wine body, and then so this sort of falls into that. This, you know, in terms of Pinot Noir, I'm looking for plushness, richness, suppleness. I mean, those are all, you know, adjectives that I really seek in Pinot Noirs.
Okay, now the $64,000 question, though, is you get some of your tannin from the skins and some of your tannin from the seeds.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you maintain that balance so you have good tannin?
Well, we're getting most of the tannin from the skins, which is already ripe tannin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just gives us a lot more tricks to do. I mean, you're going to Napa Valley, you know, you go up to Howell Mountain or Mountain Viter or some of the Cabernet guys up there. I mean, because they are able to get ripe tannins, they're able to do long, long extended fermentations, mm-hmm. because they're not worrying about extracting green tannin.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's what we do. So we can extract the softer tannins in the skins by allowing the fermentations to go twice, three times longer
than normal
than I would ever think of doing if I had those darn seeds in there.
Wow. Wow.
So, George, tell me, you know, in Russian River, it's such a great place to grow Pinot. What's so different about Jay's Pinot Noir and these four different Pinots? Are they stylistically very different? Each one is different from the other, or do they all have a common thread?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, it's four. I think going up to six or seven now. it's like I'm going crazy here. You know, if you look at the Russian River, it's an amazing place. It's so diverse in terms of its soil, based on the influences of, you know, the volcanic from the geysers that we have north of us, the influences of the ash and the cinder cones within the Russian River Valley, and also the tectonic plates. I mean, uplifting, and you know, I mean, it's said, and I've only heard this and read this a couple times, that there's more diversity in soil types within our little 10-mile by 20-mile region than in all of France, and so every little pocket, every little valley could have different sun exposure, it could have different soil, it could have different drainage. I mean, every little region is a gem, and they're all so diversely different. And so that's why you never see large vineyard holdings within the Russian River Valley. There are all these little 5 and 8 acre vineyards because that's people are trying to carve out these little unique little areas of either topography or soil.
Now, are you using different clones, or are you using the same clone for you?
Now we have 13 clones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we got 13 clones, and for your listeners, you know, the clone is, they're all Pinot Noir, it's all Chardonnay, or it's all Cabernet, but within the variety, the clones are slight genetic differences from one to another. And the clone actually is not a clone, meaning all Pinot Noirs are the same, but it means that it's a clone of the mother plant that it came from. So each one are genetically different, and each is unique to itself. And so the clones for Pinot, I mean, it's very unromantic for such a romantic grape. Mm-hmm. You know, the clones are like, you know, 667 and 777 and 828, 2A and 115 and 924 is the brand new one that came out. And
you got to be a real geek to know all those. I mean, you're a winemaker. You have
totally,
to know. But I'm talking
totally
about consumers.
you know, they're released from... there's a nursery in the south of France called Antav, and they release these clones for purchase. And so everybody runs out and buys them. They're buying 9924, I believe, right now, and everybody runs out and buys them. And then you have this incredibly expensive land that, you know, goes for like $120,000, $130,000 a bare acre, and you're putting these clones down, and you're just keeping your fingers crossed you've guessed right. So it's a little bit of excitement out here.
Yeah, because the Russian River really is in a growth phase right now, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, Robert, there's only so much plantable land, and that's what's driving the price up. It's very similar to Napa Valley. You know, and people now, because of that, we're starting to see an expansion of the Sonoma coast region, because the definition of the Russian River Valley is very, very legally defined. Mm-hmm. And so you just can't plant and say, okay, we're in the Russian River Valley. That's you know, call it that. So the vineyard, the prime vineyard source land is pretty much all gone. And really, there's like two main soil types that are like, that's it. One, it's gold, and coincidentally, it's called Gold Ridge, which is a very white, fluffy, light volcanic soil and decomposed sandstone, and that's where all the high rollers are growing on.
You know, and I will chime in on Lisa's question. And you know, during our tasting, it was very clear that each one of these different Pinot Noirs had its own personality.
Kind of like children, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really fun because we do, at Jay here, we do, our main blend is the Russian River, and it pretty much covers about 12 to 15 different vineyards through the entire north to south region of the valley. But, you know, I'm buying like little 2-acre, 3-acre vineyards, and we grow a little 5-acre vineyard. And to take those wines of 300 cases or so and just blend them into a larger blend would really be an injustice. So that's where these little gems, as I call them, come from, these little vineyard designates, because they're so special and so unique, in a larger blend, they'd just be lost. And so it's like that's what sort of drives the vineyard designate program here for us.
And personally, Lisa, I think that's terrific.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much so.
You know, because it's different strokes for different folks, and it has different structure and a different flavor profile. So what is the mad scientist, George, doing new at Jay with sparkling wine?
Ah, you know there's always something here.
Oh, cooking. Yeah. I mean,
well, you know, I have been, prior to my years of actually making sparkling wine here, I have been just a fan of vintage Krug champagne in Champagne, France.
That's a
and
nice thing
every
to
yeah, you like, and me both.
I have expensive tastes, but I buy this wine for extremely special occasions. Okay, mm-hmm. And we all know those are anniversaries or births or marriages, and I've just grown so fond of it, and it's so complex because they ferment it in oak. It's oak fermented, mm-hmm. and it's allowed to age in oak prior to going on tirage or when the sugar's added to create the bubbles in the bottle and mm-hmm. secondary fermentation. And so I thought, well, you know, why not? So this past year we fermented our cuvée material, which is our base wine for the sparkling wine. We fermented in French oak oval tanks. And I'm thinking, okay, this is kind of radical. I don't know if anyone in California is doing this, but it's worked for hundreds of years for Krug. So,
and you, when you say the oval tanks, how big are these compared to a barrel?
Well, a barrel is 59, 60 gallons. These tanks are about 1,500 gallons.
So they're not picking up any flavor from the wood.
No. It's just the warmer fermentation temperature and just the softness of the fermentation in the oak. And the slowness, and it's to me there's just a difference between that and the very cold, very sterile stainless steel, and so and then we allow the wines to go through another fermentation, which is the malolactic fermentation, in those tanks. So we're playing around with this, and this could be a lot of fun for us because what I'm trying to do is really accentuate the creaminess and again the mouthfeel in the sparkling wine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know what makes champagne so so wonderful, and I've written about this quite a lot. I just reviewed the Gasset and also the Henriot mm-hmm. Vintage 98. And what I love about those wines is you get that incredible creaminess, but they still have the structure.
Right.
You know, they have great acidity. They have great backbone.
Yep.
And that's hard to replicate.
No, and that's why, and to my, you know, I don't think it's ever been attempted to my knowledge within California because we've sort of developed a fruit forward style here mm-hmm. and the wines are often described as appley or they're described as citrusy and mm-hmm. they have those tones, but coming from my years of Chardonnay experience, I'm sort of going after kind of a different style with these new wines we're going to be making.
Well,
the J products will always stay the same style. The house mm-hmm. style will say, you know, if people like our J Brut or our vintage Brut, that'll stay the same. It's just that, you know, they may see something new in the years to come that will be a different departure from what we've done.
But what about the idea of following the champagne model a little more closely in terms of with your special cuvées, leaving them on the lees for longer?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yeah.
Because that way you'll lose some of that fruit forwardness, won't you?
Right, and that's what we're doing also is we're, you know, we're leaving it on the yeast. And so instead of, you know, what has been kind of, you know, with a technique that's been used around here in California for, say, 10, 15 years ago is cleaning up the wines very quickly and then utilizing the yeast in the bottle, you know, during mm-hmm. the method Champenois process to give you that creaminess. We're actually leaving the fermented wine on the yeast that fermented the wine in the either the tanks or in the oak ovals, and we're allowing the yeast cells to decompose prior to putting it in the bottle. So we're trying to give a head start to that as well.
Now, you didn't make any bubbly at Ferrari Carano, did you?
No.
So where did all this passion come from for sparkling wine? I mean, I realize
passion,
you like Krug.
So passion if you're making
that,
wine.
That shows great taste. You like Krug, but I mean, you know, it's a different beast making sparkling.
Yes, it is. Yes,
wine.
It is. And to me, you know, I've always been intimidated by it. I mean, I've had the opportunity in my past career, you know, to do with it. And I thought, sheesh, you know, this thing scares me. I don't want, you know. And then when I was here and really like, you know, this is it. You're in charge of this program. I started looking upon it as a still winemaker, not as a sparkling winemaker. And I realized that, and in talking to people from Champagne winemakers there, the same philosophy is the wine is made, really, the wine is made prior to tirage, mm-hmm. prior to adding the sugar and initiating the fermentation in the bottle. And so that's not any different than making still wine. And so I put my still wine cap on, and I'm doing all these new kind of, you know, approaches based on my still wine experience, not based on my sparkling.
Well, you know, I think you make a very good point. To have a great champagne, to have a great California sparkling wine, you have to start with a really good base wine.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to wear your winemaking hat.
I'm having fun. And then after that, it's pretty much everybody in the world follows, you know, the same procedure to take it to the finished product, you know, the same amount, you know, the sugar added to the bottle to ferment, and then later on the dosage amounts to leave, you know, the little bit of residual sugar in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much everybody that makes sparkling wine or champagne follows the same kind of path after that. So for me, the fun and the challenge is making the wine prior to going into the bottle.
Now, we only have a minute or so left. You kind of have been hinting that there's going to be a new bubbly product coming out at some point in the future. So my question would be, when might we see it, and does it have a name yet?
No, and the way it's looking, it would probably be on the lines of our late disgorged or a tête de cuvée in Champagne, and you're probably not going to see it for 7 to 8 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
you're going to age it for a while.
It's aging. Yeah, it'll probably be 6 to 7 years on the yeast, and you know, I have high expectations, but unfortunately, it's something that you can't rush.
Now, since you haven't done this before, how do you monitor the progress? Do you just pull a bottle out every once in a while and see
sure.
how it's going?
Yeah. It's very similar. You know, the fermentation for the primary fermentation starts in about early August, and it goes through say mid August. And then we allow the wine, the base wine, which is mm-hmm. very, very tart, to sit on the yeast that fermented it. Then around May, we clean the wine up. It's filtered, and then we add the sugar, and it ferments about another 2 to 3 weeks, maybe 4, in the bottle. After that, it's sparkling wine.
Now, we only have about 30 seconds left. What I was really driving at with that, and you're probably not going to have time to answer it, was how will you know whether 5 years is the right time or 6 years or 7 years?
We taste it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we taste it constantly. And it really is a progression. It's a progression. You see the evolution of the creaminess from the yeast autolysis, or the yeast breaking down, and a decrease in the fruitiness. And it's just where you want to grab it.
And, you know, I know you make a Pinot Gris. And
oh, that's my favorite.
And you're probably going to
do
something different with that, but we'll save that for another show.
Okay. I'd love to talk to you again.
George Bursick, thank you for your time, and happy holidays.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
This is all we have time for this week, Lisa.
Wow, fast half hour.
And next week you're by yourself.
Oh,
I'll be traveling in Napa. Anyway, this is Robert Whitley for Whitley Own Wine.